you. And if anyone wants to move closer to the park, feel free.
Yes.
I'm Shoaib Abdin. I'm an assistant curator at Tate Modern, specializing in photography. And I've known Haraf for a few years now. He's done several exhibitions at Tate. Most recently, he's included in the Conflict Time Photography exhibition, which closes tomorrow. So if you haven't seen it, try and make it down this weekend. And that was a really good experience to work with contemporary artists on such a big, wide-reaching show. So we've done a few things recently. But it's really great that this is the first solo show of Perez in London. And his first book has been published. So two really important things that are happening. And I thought we'd talk about the backgrounds project, and then we'll talk about the two works that are on display in the exhibition, and then we'll open up to question time. So before we talk about backgrounds, I was looking at some of your past work, and I came across the project Sarkissian Photo Center that you did in 2010. And that has a really interesting link to this backgrounds project. So do you want to tell everyone about the Sarkissian?
Sarkissian Photo Center, it's the shop, it's my father's shop actually, which exists until now in Damascus. It's still running, but there is no work. He opened the first lab, in color lab, in Syria, and it was 1976. It was, one of the first, and it was a big business for my father. We used to develop 2,000 films per day, and there were 15 employees. And it's where I grew up since my childhood. I spend more time in the shop rather than at home. In 2010, my father, he decided to stop the business because I was supposed to take over the family business, and I worked there for 12 years. I ran the shop, but then at some point I decided I want to do photography and become a photographer artist. So I left, and that was a huge debate also with my parents, none of my brothers wanted to take over because they were not interested from the beginning. So he decided to close down and rent the space as a commercial space. And from there, I decided to document, go there to the shop and document the entire lab, because all these memories I had with the lab and so I photographed the lab, and in addition to that, I asked my father to photograph me as the last customer in the shop, in the studio actually, which was there. This is the studio part in the lab. And we did, and then I combined. I showed. It was my graduation show actually in Amsterdam. And I combined this background with images of me taken by my father, in addition to portraits of my father when he was 14 years and on, when he started photography, actually, in Damascus. And from this image, I came with the idea of documenting the backgrounds.
So this is really a key image for both the previous project that you did in 2010, and then it links through to this new project backgrounds. And it's very interesting because it's very minimal compared to what you went on to do. It also relates to a long history in contemporary photography from the 70s and 80s of documenting mundane, everyday spaces. And this idea of a space encompassing something or encompassing memory within architecture. So the background projects you made over a series of time, and you documented studios, a dying trade in a way, studios that are across the Middle East from six different cities that were disappearing. And what was really interesting to me is that there's a disappearance of your own family history in relation to this disappearance of the history of photography in the Middle East and this link between the two?
It also has to do because in general photography in the Middle East, the Armenians, because I in my work I do a lot, my work is related a lot with my background, where I come from. I am Syrian and I have Armenian origins, and that's also it was one of the elements, because the photography in the Middle East was had Armenians had a lot a big key role in bringing photography during the Ottoman Empire. And if we look at 19th century photographers, there's a big chunk of photographers who started in Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, Jordan, Iraq, and even Egypt. After the genocide, they all traveled into these countries, and each one of them established its own shop or career, besides to the Armenians that were already in the Ottoman empires, that were already known before that. So that's one of the reasons. It's the disappearance was the main reason for me, because from on one hand, it's my family's business is disappeared, and I also disappeared from the business too. And second, it's all these backgrounds for me, they represent a certain period within the society and the families and so it was very interesting for me to travel around and document, and in each country it had a different approach. Mm-hmm. I was too late to do this project because for instance, when I went to Egypt, I was really looking forward because Egypt had
long history
and it's 60 million, 80 million, I guess now, population. They had a lot of photographers, especially in Cairo and Alexandria. So I went to these two cities, and I was really disappointed because the amount I photographed in these two cities didn't exceed 55 backgrounds. And it was the only city that I had to pay to photograph the background. The rest was not...
So you originally... Was the original intention to photograph studios that had been set up by Armenians over the past 100 years, or was that not possible?
Sorry, the main reason?
Yeah, were you searching for studios that were owned by Armenian people?
At the beginning, the initial idea was Armenians, but then I realized there are no Armenians left. I mean, especially in Cairo, you could see the studio banners are still there, but the owner or the photographer, he passed away and nobody took over. Mm-hmm. So then the idea shifted into
a bigger
project. Yeah.
Mm. So maybe we should have a look at some of these images. So when I was looking through this project, there's this strange relationship to fantasy and role play and acting in a way. And it's this it's almost surreal when you look at these images. And it's links to this idea of having a business and making a studio and it being a dream to succeed in something and have this very strong family business, but then also what it meant to be photographed in a studio like this. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about culturally how important it was to be photographed in a studio, to have your portrait taken, and what they were used for, and how these images spread around throughout the community.
I think it was very important in the region because whenever there was festivities such as the New Year or the Eid after Ramadan or the sacrifice year, I'm talking in Syria, but of course in most of these countries they have the same. Families used, the first thing they used to go before visiting relatives and celebrating, they used to go dressed all up,
best clothes,
and they go to the photographer to take this souvenir image. In the old times also, the nice thing was the photographer really played a big role in this imagination journey that he took the clients, because there was these aeroplanes, there was... I don't know, buses or fishing net or like, which with the digital, all these aspects disappeared completely. It became, they still imagine things, but it's beyond our imagination. It's, I don't know, they do so many things now with the Photoshop and the background. You just don't, immediately you don't believe anything from the image anymore, except the person.
Yeah, but within the studio space, it was, the photographer was transporting the sitter to an idealistic location.
Exactly.
It was transporting them from this place to somewhere else, to this ideal location.
It completely shifted into another world. Mm. And that was really interesting. I mean, it was really nice to see someone, I mean, in Damascus, where he's photographing in front of the Alp mountains, skiing or... And of course, there are some other extremes, being a soldier with like a machine gun or all this stuff.
Yeah. And this process was really widespread, wasn't it? It wasn't something that only the elite would go and get done. It was a huge majority of the population.
At the beginning, I mean, really beginning of history of photography, yes, it was elite, but then it gradually changed
popular.
Because also photography became cheaper. For consumers as well, but it was considered important for the, and now with the digital people don't go anymore, and this it also has to do with the social how community society is heading towards more into a more closed societies. Because they don't want the photographer to look at your picture, so they don't go to the studio anymore to photograph, or even to bring films to, or not films anymore, photos to print them.
Yeah.
They don't want anybody sees this. So that's another reason that this profession is disappearing.
Because the interaction is
yes.
So none of the images have titles. You don't reveal which cities they were taken in or which locations they were taken in. And that was really kind of interesting for me to think about, because it's the flattening out of time and space. You know you're somewhere in the Middle East, but once you're inside this room with no windows, no daylight, you could be anywhere. You could be in any city. I don't know what's happened. And was that something you noticed when you were photographing? So you would visit a different city, but it would essentially be the same.
Actually, there were differences in these cities and also in the backgrounds. For instance, when I went to Amman in Jordan, there was the Bedouin element was very strong in these studio settings. Always the coffee making thing or a tent. Or but some of other general things that are still there. But when I went to Beirut, for instance, there was this fake piano thing. It's more classy installation. In Istanbul, there were no settings. There were only backgrounds. But I think it has also to do with I was late. So they only use the painted backgrounds or backdrops, and they don't use settings because it's also for the costs of buying materials and in Cairo and Alexandria nobody is using them anymore. They were all rolled up and full of dust. It was these images I'm showing, they are from window shops and studios from Cairo and Alexandria actually.
So we know that there's this really long history of this, and you're trying to capture the end of that in a way. Did you also look at archival imagery and archival photographs that were taken in the same locations, and were you interested in linking that to this work in any way?
No, I didn't look because most of them got rid of their archive because of some of them said because it takes so much space they just got rid of them, and this is in this was the case in most of the studios. But for me, the idea was more to catch these last backdrops that exist.
Mm-hmm.
That they, I think they will disappear within coming few years. Everybody will just throw it away.
So you're using photography to capture something that's
disappearing,
and to capture a memory for yourself and also for the collective community. And so the Arab Image Foundation obviously collects a lot of these studio archives and studio portraiture. Was that something that you were thinking about as well, that there's this active, this conscious effort to hold on to this history and not let it disappear?
I don't think there is this culture anymore. I think it's it comes from the older generation. I don't think the new generation is interested just to go to the photographer and be photographed. I don't think they do that unless the photographer goes to their private place and photograph them within their own setting.
And there's a difference between you showing the work in a gallery space and the book that you've now produced. You, have you exhibited the project before as an installation in a gallery?
Yeah. The thing with this project, I was able to do the project because I won a prize a few years ago, and that allowed me to travel and to these six different cities and work for a... I think it was for a 6 month time, and in return for the prize I had to give them something, so I printed big prints from I selected only six images from out of 355, and I gave them one copy of these images. But initially the idea in my head when I started, it was a book project rather than having them printed. But they looked also, I mean, I like it also to see it on the wall, because the way I installed the print was, it was a backlight print, let's say like this, and I put the back, the light at the back, and they looked similar, like it's reviving the backdrop again.
Yeah. So you were physically putting something in the space that resembled the image. And I was curious to know, when you were doing this project, you mentioned that sometimes you had to pay to photograph the studios. What was the reaction of the studio owners or the workers?
That,
or the
these are really antique. It's really old pieces.
Did they understand? Did you explain to them about the project, or did they understand why you were doing it? Or what
they totally understood, and I think they just didn't care. it's something that brought money for them, and... the thing is, when they put down the, some of them had only blank backdrop, so I didn't want to disappoint them then, so I had to take the picture.
So there was lots of editing involved. So this is your first photo book, and photo books is something that I'm really interested in. I've been collecting them for quite a long time, because there's this strange thing when you create an object that it's about preservation, it's about preserving a project at a specific moment in time. It's published now, and it's and that's going to be how it's seen for many, many years. So it's about preservation, and it's also about circulation. It's a very good way to get your images out into the public and get things moving around. So what's your ideal scenario? How do you want this book to function within the space, and where would you like it to be seen? Who would you like to read it? Who would you like to pick it up?
I think I would like everybody to pick this book, because it's something already died. It doesn't exist anymore. And I try to make it as simple as possible with the book.
Can you maybe talk a little bit about the editing process and what you were trying to
achieve? I think the editing was very easy for me, because I knew exactly what I wanted. I just wanted to put everything in the book. But the problem was, I had so many images. I had 350 images. So I did a selection, I think around 50, 55 images. They were printed page size, and left the other ones as thumbnails in the book. So people can still see it, but it's not, then the book doesn't become like a big book.
And did you find it very different editing things on a page rather than editing things to be printed and shown in a gallery?
Yes, it's a different process.
Yeah.
But I think I was so happy with just the idea of having a first book, so it went smooth. And this project, especially this project, I think it's not very complicated to be presented as a format book format, a book format.
So this is a very strange image we're looking at now.
So these images, they were not used in the book, so that's why I thought to bring something different.
So what is happening here? You would get your portrait taken and then they would print it on cardboard so that you
and
have a life-size
it out.
Life-size replica
of yourself. Yeah. They cut it out and then you bring it home. I think the weirdest images I've seen, it was in Cairo and Alexandria. Because they could do so many things. There is no limit with Photoshop to imagine, to do things, and it costs nothing for them, because the working time or the value of work, it's not it's really nothing. So they just keep doing, and if the customer doesn't like it, then they will do something else. These are old studios.
Would you like to say anything else about this project before we move on?
No, I'm very happy for the book, actually.
Yeah.
Just arrived today, so I'm still celebrating.
Looks amazing. The colour in the book is fantastic.
It's really
great.
Thank you for the mosaic room also.
Yeah.
I did a big...
So, because this exhibition is just open and because we're sitting in the space, I thought we should probably talk about the work that's surrounding us. And there's two projects on display in this exhibition, upstairs and downstairs. But for me, when I came on Thursday night, there was this immediate realization that you've made a departure from traditional photography, in a sense. A lot of your previous work is quite traditional, quite straight photography, taken on a very complex camera, very complex printing processes. And this is really experimenting with different ways of viewing photography. And this is part of something that's been happening throughout the world recently. Contemporary photographers really pushing the boundaries and taking things off the wall and bringing things into the gallery space. And thinking about photography not as a two-dimensional medium, but as a possibility to explore many different things. So I guess the installation of Frontline in the front room, it's the first time you've done an installation in a space like that.
Yeah. It's right, I come from a very conservative photographic background. That's true. Something has changed in me in when I studied, because I didn't study until 2008. I studied 2 years in Amsterdam at the Rietveld Academy, and I always have had this fight with my teacher because I use large format camera. It's really immobile, and I have to plan before going anywhere to do a project. So I always had this fight with him that he wanted me to go and photograph with the mobile, and it never worked out, of course. But it, from there, it created this this new feeling that I wanted to do something different in the way, try to not avoid, but try to do something different than, because in photography in general, everything has been done concept-wise or a topic or whatever, formats also. So that's why I also like the idea of printing these portraits on Perspex for the first time. And it also related to the... Because I thought about these people, these were rebels who fought during the war. They were retired when I photographed them, and I'm sure they are still retired. Some of them, they lost legs or arms. So they just go to the union. They have a union... they go there and play backgammon or cards. So for me, they look like almost their life is finished after the war. They don't do anything else. And And that's why I wanted to present them as tombs, actually, in front of this image, which represents a war memorial in Nagorno-Karabakh.
So this idea of time is very interesting in relation to this piece, because the conflict happened between 88 and 94, and then you photographed them in 2007, and now you're exhibiting it in 2015. So there's also delay in time, and thinking about what the conflict meant while it was happening and when it ended in 94, what it meant to them when you photographed them in 2007, and how they thought about the conflict looking back, and then also how it ends up in the space now. And I guess when I was looking at it, it looks very much like a memorial, but it's a memorial to the living in a way. It's a memorial to the living as much as it's a memorial to the dead.
I will tell you that the reason I had this lapse, I couldn't go before 2007 because I was very young and I couldn't go there. But when I went 2007, my idea of this project was to photograph these landscapes and then photograph the rebels who fought and ask somebody from the other side of Azerbaijan, because I cannot go there, to photograph rebels who also participated in this war. But I couldn't reach to someone and ask him. I don't think it's easy also to ask a photographer to do a work you want to do the way you want. So
so you wanted a collaboration, but you didn't.
Yeah, exactly. It was not possible because eventually I wanted to create this war zone in a space with these landscapes, images, and these people facing each other, and the audience would be in the middle. Because I haven't seen the war. I've only seen on TV and news. And when I went there, it was completely different because I started to listen to the stories and I had a real brainwash of how cruel was the war. Over 1 million people were exiled from both sides. They were all living in harmony together for such a long time, but they all were exiled, and it reminded me of our story of the Armenians who were exiled too, and now we're doing the same thing. A lot of people from diaspora also went to fight, actually. So I really didn't feel, I felt really bad, and after also meeting the rebels, talking with them, I was not satisfied with showing the work. And that's why I kept it in the drawer, actually, and I didn't show it. And now, after 7 years, I'm showing it because I'm talking about it, and I can tell because I think I'm in peace now with the with the work.
So it's also about recontextualizing something, and conflicts and how we look at conflict always changes over different periods of time depending on the state of our society's thinking at the time. So really you're recontextualizing something in several different ways here.
Yeah, it's a very small scale of what could war bring. I think that's why I also chose the title Imagined Futures. It also relates to what is happening now to Syria, but not, of course, directly, but it's, again, about the war, destruction, people leaving their homes for no reason. It's only for stupid reasons. And I think that's how I linked this war to also to Syria, where I come from.
Yeah. And it's also a return, obviously not in this room. This room, for me, is more of how I think about your work. Often landscapes or architectural spaces that encompass a certain memory or a certain history. But the work in the front room is a return to the portrait in a way, and actively bringing the physical body back into the work. And you haven't done that for a very long time.
I have only two series that I photographed people. I'm not very good in looking at someone and photographing him. I think my daughter is the only one where I photographed her more than 3,000 photos. so I think I photographed them, and there was this project, it's called Zabiba, people who pray and they have the stain on their forehead. And for me, that project was more about the stain rather than the character or the face. I think that's another reason for keeping the project in the drawer, because I was not feeling okay showing portraits.
Yeah, and to have someone staring back at you is a very powerful thing.
Yes.
And obviously staring at you, you often talk about yourself behind the camera and how that idea of taking the image behind the camera. And you've managed to portray that to the audience in this work very well, I think. Mm-hmm. That we also get the feeling that we're being stared back at by someone. We're also being reflected upon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's very good. And the film downstairs, this is also a very big departure away from things that you've done before.
Yeah, my last video.
First and last video. So it's an experimentation into moving image, but of course it's made from stop motion images, hundreds or thousands of images.
I mean, now you know my work, and you can see my work also in the video. It's more photographic rather than a video. The reason I did this work because the war started in Syria, I refused to do any work about it because I don't live there and I haven't seen anything there, and I also feel bad for the people who are living there, to do a work and then put it in a gallery and stand in front of it, take pictures. So I decided to do a work that it also can go global. It's about home, losing home, someone's home. And it can be a natural disaster, it can be war, it can be for any reason. And the idea was, because my family are still living in Damascus and they are my last, I don't have anything else in Damascus except them. Of course, memories, that's something I cannot erase. So I always have this fear that something will happen to our house where I grew up and where they are still living in the building. So I decided to build this model, which is exactly the same, looks like my parents' building.
It's a scale model.
Yeah, it's a scale model 1 to 30. It's made out of forced concrete, and it was exactly like built like with raw materials, like a usual building. I worked with an architect to build it, and I wanted to destroy it with the sledgehammer and documented. And the idea of destroying is the fear that it's always there, that I will lose this place, and also to break this image that I always carry it with me of the house, of the home. So that's it. Had two layers for the
it has many layers because it's sculptural in a sense, the way that you thought about and constructed this space, and actually put it in a white cube. When you were photographing it, you put this building into a white cube, similar to how you photograph someone in a studio, so the object was becoming the main focus point. And then there's a performative element as well,
yeah,
where you include yourself in the work, probably for one of the first times that you're physically present in your work.
Yes, I mean, I have... Yeah, it's the first time actually. I used to photograph myself in 2003 and 2004. But
maybe we'll see that project in
10
years.
Time.
But was it very important to you that you were the one that was destroying this building, and that you were physically present, and it was performative rather than an absent? And someone that was absent that was destroying it?
Well, the initial idea was that I wanted to destroy the building, but it was impossible physically because the sledgehammer was over 5-6 kilos. Mm-hmm. And I tried to hit twice and I couldn't carry on. Nothing happened to the building, actually. So that's... That's the technical reason. The reason I included myself, it's I think it gives another dimension to the work, just me being there.
And you're obviously, you're kind of living in exile at the moment, so you can't be there, you can't go and visit this
location. I can. No, I wouldn't consider myself exile, because I mean I left on my own will and I was not kicked out, or I can go back, of course, but I would never guarantee that I can leave again. Because now they are recruiting, so I have a family here, my children, wife, so I don't want to jeopardize and go there and then get stuck, because I would never know what would happen. So that's the reason I refuse to go back.
Yeah, it's kind of because you don't want to go back, you then made a replica of this home.
Yeah.
It's a very, it's a very powerful thing to think about home and memory and what that entails.
Well, after 4 years, I mean, I've been following the news every day, but at some point, I just it's become really disgusting to look at or read the news. What's happening now? So the only image that I try to keep in my head is my parents' home. That's the only thing actually left.
I wonder, should we open it up to some questions now?
Sure.
If anyone wants to ask Herrera anything about any of his works, actually. Yes. We'll start here and work our way back. So, yeah.
Thank you very much for sharing the thoughts with us. My question is in relation to the decision of having two screens. Versus, let's say, perhaps two screens with each other, or, you know, a formal documentation way of, you know, portraying the work. And I was thinking of having two screens of leaving the view in between the destroyed and the destroyer, perhaps the space in between the past and the present and the future. So I was wondering whether you can serve, you know, a great thought on that.
I mean, this is for me for the first time I install video, so I'm not. My main idea to do these opposite screens is just to put the viewer within these two things that are happening. You know, that's. I think that's the only way I saw it. And I tried in another. We showed another somewhere else. It was a big screen of the building and a smaller monitor of me. Hitting. I haven't seen the installation, but I mean, it could have been next to each other too.
There's also this tension of being the viewer standing between these two action points that are going on, and you do feel this tension between the destroyed and the destroyer.
That's true.
It's quite interesting to be in that environment.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you for a really poignant exhibition. Thank you guys for the talk, it's really interesting. I kind of want to go back to your photo book and how you take photographs of backgrounds and how perhaps these days you're talking about digital photography and how it's mass produced and the nature of it, at least, with stop imagery and mobile photography becoming really, really common ground. My question is, how do you try and ensure that these images that you take, which are really emotively heavy, aren't lost to a desensitized culture?
What do you mean with desensitized culture?
So the sort of frequency that we are sort of, I guess, bombarded with on television, on social media. Perhaps people might get desensitized. How do you try to not lose the substance of your photography, which is very close to you, to this culture of mass produced images?
I think that these backdrops were massly used, but they are not used anymore. So I don't. It becomes more a reference to a memory. rather than, I don't think we can compare it with what is happening now, with the mass production of war images or mobiles or, I don't know if that answers your question.
But I also think with your work, you do this very subtle thing where you quite often show a series with a group title, and quite often things aren't what they appear. So a lot of the time when we're bombarded with everyday imagery, we think we automatically know its meaning and know its intention. But with your work, there's a lot more subtlety in actually finding out as the viewer, why am I looking at this? Why has someone deliberately gone out and made this image for me? And also the use of, I guess the use of a very old technology in a way is also helps.
Because I don't do mass images. Mm. I mean, I photograph, 10 images per year. Mm-hmm. So I don't have a digital camera to.
Sure. Mm-hmm. I was kind of more talking from an audience perspective, how we are sort of, we receive a lot of images from our how do you, my question was, how do you make sure that your images of tanks and other conflicts and these distressing things isn't lost to this repetitive feeding of what we see on the news every day? It's the quality of the work, it's amazing. Indeed, it has been absolutely lost.
And it's also, you see the image after 14 years, 15 years, and I think that's the. And it talks about what happened. It's more history rather than now.
Mm-hmm.
So, I never thought about this, actually.
And was there another one? Yeah.
My question is about the installation of the first group. I want to know if the piece was supposed to be interactive or that you have to look through between the tombstones. And because it was double-sided on the first face, but you only had a background on one side and on the other. I want to know a bit more about the background, whether the background is the past or how they were going to see the past.
The background is a war memorial, actually. There's this small sculpture. I don't know if you've seen it. A very small sculpture in the middle of the image. And that's the war memorial of Nagorno-Karabakh, from the Armenian side, of course. And it would have been really nice that people can... I think you can still walk around, but... The space is, the beginning we were thinking to show it here in this space, but I, because I have only 17 images showing here, I don't think it would fill the space and you wouldn't have this impression that you're squeezed within these people and you won't have this connection. I think rather they are more squeezed and they make you feel uncomfortable. That's what I feel. But
can you tell us just a bit more on the scale model you built for Nasdaq? You haven't done it in the last week, so was it done here?
It has, no, I've done it in Jordan actually, because we were living in Jordan and I had the opportunity of a studio, also budget wise, it's cheaper to do it there than here in England.
And did you have to use some lab explosives after you failed with your number?
No. We destroyed everything with the sledgehammer. There was someone special, the builder himself, who built it. He destroyed it 1 week later. He was surprised. Why do you want to destroy it? We just made it destroy. So I explained to him, and he was really amazing. He was also from Palestine, so he understood the kind of interacted in the project. But. At the end, his arms were like this size. Mm-hmm. It took him 8-9 hours to finish the whole thing down, to put it down.
Yeah. When I look at your work, there seems to be quite a lot about relationships anyway, like your relationship to yourself and to your family, and then how stuff affects other people. I guess that was just my comment, and also I just wondered what your father thought about your project with the photo studios.
Well, my father hasn't seen this because he totally has a different point of view, and we definitely would argue about this. But it's sad to talk about this project to my father because he's been a photographer for 30 years and after he became a lab owner. He became a photographer. He didn't do any weddings or social kind of photography. So he opened. So for him, it's really sad. On a personal level, he's losing his lab. Nobody took over, but now he realizes that was a good decision for me that I left. And second, it's the wider. The wider aspect of photography that it's, I mean, he doesn't enjoy photography anymore like he did before because of this mass production. Everybody takes pictures, everybody's a photographer, you know. It's a different mentality than his generation.
Do you feel that you have it's curiosity that drove you for the photography, the studios, and did it process, did you anything about your decision to leave behind that family business?
Well, that became before this. I mean, I had a for many years I had problems with my family because of leaving the family business, and I mean I suffered from that before I started this project, and of course it had something to do with this too. So, yeah.
So you're very sad about this.
So many things.
You're sad about this dying trade, but then also it's a double-edged sword for you.
Yeah, it is.
Also,
yeah, I mean, for me, it was a really big decision because the family had a really good business in Syria, and I finished high school, and the first thing I wanted to do is to go and work with my father. Mm-hmm. It's not because he's my father, because I love this this work. Mm-hmm. So he said, "No, you have to go and study. I don't want you to blame me after later." So I went to 2 weeks to the university in Damascus, but I couldn't cope. So I said, "I'm leaving." So I went back to the shop. I started to work again. It was a full-time job.
So everything is intertwined.
Yeah.
Why did you go to university?
To leave Syria. I mean, that was the only way to go to Europe, mm-hmm. let's say. But I always wanted to study, but it was so expensive for me to go abroad because I had plans to go, for instance, to Canada in the 90s, but it was like over $20,000 per year tuition fee, and you could buy a house in Syria for that money. Mm-hmm. So I didn't. And when I went to study, it was really funny. All of my colleagues, I mean, I was 36, they were all 23, 24, mm-hmm. and I was the only student who was represented by a gallery already. Which is quite strange, but it went. I mean, it was a very good experience for me. Mm-hmm. It opened up many on many levels.
And your work is very personal to you, to your background, to your history. I just wondered how comfortable you feel with sharing so much of yourself with us, and how much is your work? When I look at downstairs, I almost see it.
I mean, the work downstairs didn't do. I mean, it you can see it as a therapy, but actually, I still have the same feelings that I had before doing this. It's not less because they still live there, my parents, and I still think about them. Well, I don't think I have issues to share. Like, I would not share everything with you or with the public, the personal stories. But on a certain level, I do share. Yes.
Because your work is extremely personal.
Yes.
I think that's all. Thank you very much for coming, and thank you, Hera.